Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage pediatric gastrointestinal specialist, Dr. Claire Wilson. We'll be discussing celiac disease, food allergy, and any other topic you'd like to choose. So take the time to give us a call or email. Other potential topics might be GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease, or some of the inflammatory bowel disorders. You can reach us locally in Anchorage at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Wilson trained and got her medical degree at the University of Southern California Medical School. Then did a GI fellowship, that is an extra training in gastrointestinal illnesses at Los Angeles Children's Hospital. Spent 20 years in Hawaii, both in private practice and on the faculty at the University of Hawaii before going to Stanford for a couple of years, and then has arrived up here and has been in practice almost a year at the Providence Pediatric Gastrointestinal Clinic. Dr. Wilson, it's a pleasure. We've not done pediatric gastrointestinal diseases in my 10 years I've done this, so it's nice to have you here.
Thanks very much for asking.
I'm going to ask you to start by just describing a little bit about pediatric gastroenterology, what you do, and in particular the kinds of things and disorders and questions you get from patients on a daily basis, so we have a little bit better understanding about you.
Okay. Well, I think it's helpful first to know that I was a pediatrician before I was a pediatric gastroenterologist, and then did extra training in that field. Our day consists of inpatient work, consults, and endoscopies, and outpatient clinic visits. Probably the most common things that we see in our office would be things like babies who are spitting up, children with constipation, children with abdominal pain. We also have occasional child with liver disease, inflammatory bowel disease, occasional celiac disease and food allergies. And then, you know, the odd thing here and there, pancreatitis, et cetera. We also see a fair number of children who need nutrition support. That's part of our training as well.
Okay. You mentioned the word endoscopy. So expand on that. What do you mean by endoscopy, and where are you looking with that endoscope?
Well, an endoscope is a flexible fiber optic instrument that we insert either in the child's mouth or in their bottom, and we, with that, can look at the lining of these areas. I tell patients it's kind of like looking at my hand right now. I can see if it's red or if there's a big sore in the middle of it. And we're also able to do things through the scope, take little biopsies, remove polyps using specialized instruments that we can insert through there. We do that in our endoscopy unit. They're not office procedures because they require anesthesia or sedation.
Okay. And that's been a big advance in all of medicine, both, I guess, in pulmonary, but especially in gastrointestinal and some of the urinary services. They've got these unbelievably small pieces of equipment that can allow you to look like you're looking at your hand or something on your skin and then do things with that. And it's really helped with the ease of diagnosis and accuracy, I would guess. How long have those been available?
The first ones were rigid scopes, actually. Surprisingly, they even endoscoped the upper GI tract with rigid scopes, which always seems like sword swallowing to me. But those go back many, many decades. As I recall, the fiber optic instruments started to come in around the 70s or so. And, of course, they become more and more sophisticated as time has gone on.
Okay. We have a caller. Someone called in already, and I suspect she's or he has been waiting for this question for a while, so I want to go ahead and take his call. Nevin, you're on line one?
Yes, good afternoon.
What can we do for you?
Well, I'd be interested in learning a little more about the term H. pylori, how it affects you, and what is the adverse effect, and what is the treatment you would provide for that?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a relatively new, somewhat new bacteria that is been. We know a lot more about it than we did 20 years ago, let's say that. So I'll ask Dr. Wilson to kind of bring us up to date on H. pylori.
Well, H. pylori stands for Helicobacter pylori, and it's a bacteria that lives in your stomach and can cause inflammation in your stomach. And some decades ago, it was found to be one of the causes of ulcer disease. You know, we used to think ulcer disease was caused by too much coffee and stress and that sort of thing. And now we know that the two main causes are Helicobacter infection and NSAID medications like ibuprofen, Motrin, that sort of thing. So Helicobacter is one of the causes of ulcer disease. But the important thing to know about it, I think, is that for most people who have it, they have no symptoms whatsoever. It's not something that's a universal problem if you happen to have it, such as a urinary tract infection or something like that.
So the presence of it is maybe a carriage state or a normal inhabitant of the gastrointestinal tract. It is a problem when it causes disease.
Correct.
All right. So, Nevin, have you got problems or you have a question about a particular kind of symptom?
No, not at all. I was just recently diagnosed with it, complaining of severe heartburn,
mm-hmm.
and they did a very simple test, and within 10 minutes came back, said, you have H. pylori, and put me on a series of medicine, and a matter of about 3 weeks, I was amazed it cleared it up.
Right. Yeah. Comments?
It sounds like the H. pylori infection was either interfering with your stomach motility so that you had more reflux or heartburn, or maybe it was giving you gastritis that was the cause of your pain.
Yes, what surprised me is I suffered from this for years, and the slightest spicy foods that I had seemed aggravated, but boy, now the world is my laid on the table for me. I can eat anything, and it's great.
And the interesting thing about that is I could hear this exact same story from another person who had the infection, got treated, and felt exactly the same way afterwards. And unless they had an ulcer. If they have an ulcer, it's different. Then mm-hmm. we know that it needs to be eradicated or the ulcer won't heal properly.
Well, I appreciate the information. I thank you.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Good luck, Nevin. This brings up an important issue of the thing we've talked about a lot on this program is cause and effect. Just because you have something present with a symptom, it doesn't necessarily mean the two are related. In Nevin's situation, there's even more evidence. He's had the same symptoms for a long time, and they all went away with treatment. It's not, again, 100% proof, but it's very, very suggestive. And that's one of the problems we get is I see people in pediatrics, anyway, ordering these Helicobacter studies for kids with all kinds of symptoms, and a large percentage of people are going to have positive, but that positive may have nothing to do with their symptoms. Is that reasonable for people to understand?
I think that's important for people to understand for a couple of reasons. Is that we don't want to necessarily identify everybody in the world who has this infection and treat them, because a certain number of those people whose symptoms had nothing to do with the infection are going to get sick from the medications that they're given. And secondly, and maybe more importantly, the people for whom we really need to get rid of that infection because it's causing them serious disease, our medications are going to be useless once the bacteria becomes resistant to them. And that's already started to take place. So I think you put that together with everything else you know about the person, what their symptoms are, and you may decide to do an endoscopy to mm-hmm. actually see what's there and what isn't. Mm-hmm. And then, as in many times in medicine, we make the best decision we can with the information that you have in consultation with your medical professional.
So one thing I guess I want to make sure everybody hears again, lots of people may have H. pylori in their stomach and have no long-term consequences of that.
That's correct. There's some interesting kind of preliminary data surfaces every once in a while that I think is fascinating about how certain diseases may actually be less prevalent in people who have H. pylori. Mm. So there may be a downside to eradicating it in some people. Mm. I think you have to really take it on a case-by-case basis.
Mm-hmm. And it gets into the whole issue of risks and benefits of treatment, and certainly there's a lot of information coming out. I don't think we want to necessarily get into it in this program about how many medications are changing gastrointestinal flora, and that may not be as good as it would appear, and certainly may cause some side effects that we hadn't known about for a long, long time. Well, I would like to now talk about celiac disease. If there's a hot item in medicine, I guess it would be celiac disease. And my 64 years tells me when things get really exciting, both physicians and patients have a tendency to overinterpret and overdiagnose, and then we finally kind of come back down to reality, kind of oscillate around findings. I have a feeling that we're all a little bit too anxious about celiac disease, but a lot of current findings, in at least the good medical literature I see, suggest that quite a bit of symptoms might be related to celiac disease, and there's more of it than we had thought maybe when I was first trained. So let's flesh out celiac disease with the best information we can.
Okay. Well, first of all, just to start off with what celiac disease is, it's a damage to the small intestinal lining by the wheat protein in people that have a genetic predisposition to have that damage take place. In the old days, we diagnosed this by looking at patients and finding out about their symptoms. So we look for example, children that weren't growing well, who had big pot bellies and very little buttock fat and were irritable and had chronic diarrhea. And the only way back then to test them for celiac disease was to do a small intestinal biopsy and see whether they had those characteristic changes of the disorder. And then along the way, we developed some blood tests that turned out to be very good screening tests for celiac disease. The first ones that came along were not very accurate, and I can remember very clearly using those tests as screening tests and biopsying many people who turned out to have normal biopsies who had positive tests on their first generation, if you will, of those tests. And as time has gone on, those tests have gotten more and more accurate. The two that are recommended now by our pediatric GI specialty society are the tissue transglutaminase IgA and the total IgA as screening tests. And these serve as a way of telling you who doesn't need a biopsy. It's important to realize they are not diagnostic by themselves. So when somebody has these tests done, either because they have symptoms that suggest they might have celiac disease, or maybe they have a condition that we know is associated with celiac disease, like type 1 diabetes or Down syndrome. And if they get positive results or equivocal results, then we need to take that next step by doing the intestinal biopsy to verify that that's really their disorder. And it's very important not to have their diet change in the meantime, because that can change the results of our most definitive test, which is still the biopsy. So the treatment for celiac disease, once it's been fully diagnosed, is strict avoidance of the gluten protein. So that's in wheat, barley, and rye. And we usually say oats too, not because oats are necessarily problematic by themselves, but because they're processed on the same machines that are processing these other more harmful grains. And so we have people stay away from them. There's also a lot of hidden sources of gluten in foods that you wouldn't think are related to wheat at all. And so I think it's important when we've made the diagnosis to have a child sit down with a dietitian and in detail go over where these hidden sources of gluten might be. They might be in candy. They might be in some medications even. And so the family can completely avoid these items. And when they do that, they can actually normalize their intestinal lining.
The early descriptions that you commented on were the ones that I was trained in, and basically they related to, I think, of fat malabsorption. You had this injury to your small intestine, and so you had an inability to digest foods. Fat was a huge source of calories, so you had these bloated kids that looked like they were with no fat, especially on their buttocks. I mean, these are classic signs. But now I'm guessing that, like asthma and many other ills, we're recognizing that 20 years ago we were seeing the tip of the iceberg, we were seeing the worst case, and now we're able to maybe see milder cases.
Mm-hmm.
Is that reasonable? Are we recognizing milder forms of the same disease?
Oh, absolutely. We're diagnosing people now who really have no symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
They were tested because they had an immediate family member who had verified disease, or they had one of these associated conditions. And you might think, well, why did we bother? Why did we take those extra steps and make them change their diet? If you don't do that, there's going to be long-term nutritional consequences, not just fats, but vitamins and things that are going to affect your vision and your bones and, you know, give you osteoporosis, make you anemic. A fair number of adults who are diagnosed with celiac disease reach that diagnosis because they were being worked up for anemia.
Mm-hmm. me remind our listeners, if you've got questions or comments about the program today or have topics you'd like to just have discussed, why don't you give us a call? Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433, toll-free 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Also, I would direct you to the line1alaskapublic.org website. We do have three good links, one with some very specific information about celiac disease, and the other two with lots of information about various gastrointestinal problems, particularly as it relates to childhood. One of the problems, it would seem to me, that is somewhat similar to this is now we recognize celiac disease as even being present in perhaps asymptomatic patients, but when they're well diagnosed, it is important to do that because of prognosis and long-term natural history of problems that may creep up later even though they don't have them. But somewhat similarly, it seems to me we're having patients who have all kinds of gastrointestinal complaints, put themselves on a gluten-free diet. Everything is gluten-free nowadays. You don't have any trouble finding it. And they feel better. You want to comment on that? Is that gluten? Is that celiac disease? What's the problems with that approach?
Mm. One of my sisters is doing that right now. Sorry, Nikki. I think in order to understand this situation, it's important to understand the difference between gluten intolerance and maybe wheat allergy and celiac disease. Gluten intolerance or wheat intolerance simply means that you have symptoms when you eat these items. Nobody's going to argue that with you. It's true for you, and you may choose to then avoid them to avoid those symptoms. However, you're not doing your intestine any damage by consuming those things, nor are you having an allergic reaction. So I think anybody's entitled to a food intolerance. That's for them to determine. Our job as physicians, especially with children, is to be sure that the diet that they do come to with that is nutritionally adequate. And that's when, again, we want to bring in a dietitian to review it. So intolerance just means you don't feel good in whatever way when you eat a certain thing. Allergy is a specific allergic type response to a food. And not being an allergist, I want to not go into that in any great detail. But that's distinguished from celiac disease, which, as I mentioned earlier, is this very specific gut lining damage from the wheat protein in people who have that genetic predisposition, which then leads to malabsorption of their calories, their fats, as Dr. Woodard mentioned, and their vitamins and their iron, and has nutritional and other long-term consequences. So three very different things. So there's a lot of people who are on a gluten-free diet who don't have celiac disease or, for that matter, wheat allergy, but they feel a whole lot better.
Okay. What is there a group of symptoms that we can say are most commonly associated with a good diagnosis of celiac disease?
I think you'd probably choose a combination of diarrhea, poor weight gain, maybe specific findings on physical exam. We kind of talked about that earlier. You're thin, your belly's kind of big and distended, and your lab tests are abnormal. You have evidence of malabsorption of various nutrients, and your celiac screen is positive. We don't see that type of patient very often anymore who's diagnosed with celiac disease. We much more often see the child who's referred in because they happen to have type 1 diabetes and somebody screened them because of the known association. Mm-hmm. And the good part of that is we're catching them before they, mm-hmm. Get to the point of having all those consequences.
So Down syndrome or celiac disease, which are other disorders that just happen to, for genetic reasons apparently, coexist, this disorder coexists. So those people may come in commonly without much in the way of symptoms, however, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. on good testing, as accurate as we can be, they definitely have celiac mm-hmm. disease. And mm-hmm. so their prognosis is definitely different if they get treated for that. One thing you haven't mentioned, I want to make sure is still true. I thought there was somewhat of a minor risk of gastrointestinal cancers over the long term. So it's another reason between allergy, which doesn't have that association, and celiac disease to know what's really going on.
That's right. Just like a lot of things that are connected with chronic inflammation in our body, you can get lymphoma of the intestine from untreated chronic celiac disease, because under the microscope, one of the things that's going on is inflammation, chronic inflammation. So we actually talk to patients about that. And I think the patient that you just mentioned a minute ago, it's very hard to sit there with them and say, you know, you have no symptoms whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You really didn't want to come over here in the first place. You've got enough problems. You've already got diabetes. Mm-hmm. And now somebody screened you for this. And now we're going to tell you not only do you have to deal with diabetes, but we've got to do this other thing for you. And it's a hard sell sometimes.
You know, I think that I want to expand on this idea a little bit more, because it's also affecting medicine. I grew up in an era when we thought a lot about testing, just verified diagnosis. And now, as someone who's done asthma pretty hard and heavy for about 30 years, I can recognize that I can see a child and not hear anything in their lungs, and maybe I'm pretty good at getting the right history out, but my exam doesn't help me. But if I do some pulmonary function, I see evidence of problems in a patient who otherwise says, I don't really have any problems. And that's real. And I use the analogy with them. It's like you can't tell how good your vision is till you put glasses on. You can't tell what your blood pressure is till you take blood pressure. So now we've gotten to where we are a little bit more sophisticated because of the testing, and we're finding relatively asymptomatic patients. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that asymptomatic situation is a risky thing for the future. So there's some advantages to that. So it's changed this paradigm where I was always thinking that I did lab just to make sure I had the right diagnosis. But sometimes we need the lab to really make the diagnosis in these milder or much less symptomatic. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think the thing in celiac disease that would correspond to your pulmonary function testing is some of the lab tests that we do that show that the person's a little anemic, or they're their fat-soluble vitamin levels are low, for example.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take another question. Bill, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, thank you very much. Interesting discussion. I really appreciate you airing this today and your guest. Very fascinating. If I may get a very brief comment, perhaps from your guest, on those with a relatively healthy GO tract, and really just a comment or brief comment on maybe some of the ways to maintain the health GO tract, the colon in particular. I have a question about that, like a commercial, late night commercial type thing, when you hear about this herbal medicine in order to do a colon cleanse, and really just try to get a sense of that and kind of cut through a lot of it for us laymen.
Good question. So what I'm hearing you ask is, what is the best things that a person can do to assure themselves that they have as much as they can do about good gastrointestinal health? And is it necessary to take all kinds of advertised and marketing products to improve gastrointestinal health? So that's how I heard that question.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, you bet. Good question.
Well, I think, first of all, we better just recognize it's normal to have poop in your colon, and you don't have to clean it all out to be healthy. That said, you also don't want to have a whole bunch more than you should have there. That can lead to all kinds of symptoms. And so I think for many of us, keeping your fiber in your diet high, be sure you're getting enough liquid so that your colon's not forced to reclaim liquid out of your stool is a good idea. But there's no way you're going to make yourself healthier by cleaning all your stool out, unless you do it right before your colon cancer screening colonoscopy so that your doctor can see what's in there.
Mm-hmm. And additional vitamins, herbs, minerals, supplements, can you think of anything off the top of your head that really is critical for the vast majority of people? There's always going to be people with vitamin B12 deficiency or some issue where they need something. But in general, the most of us need any particular things that we need to do that's going to help us?
Yeah. Well, I think a normal balanced diet, number one, if you're looking at what we call macronutrients, so your proteins, your fats, your carbohydrates. And then here in Alaska, we have to pay more attention to vitamin D. My whole career, I worked in places like Hawaii and California where we really didn't have to think about that. But since I've been here, I find that you do have to take extra vitamin D. Beyond that, the American Academy of Pediatrics, I believe this is still their current position, it feels that you should be getting your vitamins from your foods, shouldn't be, you know, having a poor diet and then trying to make up for it by taking vitamins. So that would sort of be my bottom line response to that.
Yeah, I think the general evidence is that is right. Is you're eating healthy, get some good exercise. I think we're finding consistently that exercise is helpful to not only our noggins and how well we think, but also the way the rest of our body works. And so I think that's an important aspect just to bring up. But most of the time, you want to be careful of those things that are marketed over the TV. They're not likely to have as good evidence and there's probably some bias towards wanting some of your money in those reports.
The other thing to remember, too, is that many of these products aren't regulated by the FDA, so you don't even know really what you're getting, how much of the product is what they say it is, et cetera.
Right. Now, that's an important point that we've talked about a number of times. Due to federal or congressional action, medications that are prescription have to be shown to be safe and effective to be marketed by the companies that make them. That is not true of supplements, herbs, and vitamins, despite the fact that no matter how you want to describe it, they're a medication or a drug, anything that goes into your body and has some action. But anyway, that's another story, but it is much less regulated industry, and so there's a lot less evidence of safety and effectiveness in those kind of products. We're really already halfway through this program, so I'm going to have to go ahead and take my first break at this particular time. I want to remind people that are listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to be gone for just about a minute, and then we'll return and talk with Dr. Claire Wilson, a pediatric gastroenterologist. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is pediatric gastrointestinal specialist, Dr. Claire Wilson, who's currently at the Providence Pediatric Gastrointestinal Clinic here in Anchorage. And we've been discussing up to this point celiac disease, general things that gastroenterologists do in their training. We're going to start off the next part of this program talking about something called fatty liver, but we're going to be also talking about food allergies, if time permits, as well as inflammatory bowel disease. I do want to make a brief comment and kind of cross-promote another program, Kids These Days Tomorrow, from 2 to 3 on KSKA, and then repeating at 7 to 8 tomorrow, is going to be talking about immunizations. Again, there's still a lot of work to be done to help people ease their concerns about immunizations, and remember to keep intact the risks and benefits of both not only doing certain medical procedures, but the risk of not doing them. Anyway, they're going to be talking with Laura Wood of the State Department of Health and Social Services and Tom Nicewander about immunizations on kids these days tomorrow. It'll be at 2 p.m., same place, and repeats tomorrow night at 7 p.m. on KSKA. So there are new things being found all the time, and now we're in Western countries all over the world having a problem with too much food and too little exercise. That's leaving us in a too much caloric overbalance, and we're all getting heavier. And there are consequences to that. One that we may not have heard so much about is fatty liver.
Mm-hmm. And if you've heard about it, you might not realize that children get it too. It's probably the big up-and-coming liver disease in pediatrics. And as Dr. Woodard mentioned, it's because we have so many more overweight children now that are staying home doing video games and eating too much food. We see children in our practice who may get referred either because somebody happened to ultrasound their abdomen and saw that they had changes that look like there's fat in their liver, or more frequently, somebody gets one of those chemistry panels that has a whole bunch of tests on it because they have a machine that can do two tests for the price of one or two, and you find out that the child has elevated liver enzymes, and then it's a matter of finding out if it's due to fat in the liver or something else.
What's the consequences of that? So you see a little extra fat in the liver.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's two consequences. One is it's a sign that you have too much fat other places too. You're going to have the same problems with being overweight, with regards to your heart or breathing, some children with sleep apnea, for example. And then specifically to the liver, some of these children will go on to actually develop fibrosis, which can go into cirrhosis. And there have been occasional children who have really developed major health consequences from that. Rarely even require liver transplantation. So it can be severe. That said, I think most of them don't reach that point. They have pure fat in the liver and not the fat plus fibrosis. And for them, it's more of a sign of their overall obesity problems.
Mm-hmm. All right. We've got a couple of callers. Kaylee, you're on line one.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I was calling, my friends and I, we all have kids that are, between the 2 to 5 year old range, and, we all take healthy eating very seriously. And I've noticed that more and more of my friends are tending to go to a gluten-free diet, and I can't help but feel like they're doing it because it's trendy. And like, some of them aren't even getting diagnoses, but some of them are from their doctors. And I was wondering, because this is something that society is really starting to pay attention to, that, wheat intolerance and celiac disease are things that do cause some people problems. Do you think that doctors are kind of handing that out as a solution, because people tend to want an answer for why they're not feeling good? And do you think that maybe this diagnosis is being given out a little bit more freely than it necessarily is affecting the population? Because I've noticed it's really almost the cool thing to be like, oh, we're gluten-free.
Yeah, isn't that something about our society? I'll ask Dr. Wilson to respond.
Are you talking about gluten intolerance, or are you talking about celiac disease?
Well, some of them have not even gotten. I mean, there's one of my friends, actually, the doctor said that her child had celiac disease. One other person was like, well, we think they have a wheat intolerance, and some of them haven't been to the doctor. They just are gluten-free. And I just wonder if it's really as prevalent as it's seeming to be, because, 2 years ago, you never saw a single gluten-free thing in the grocery store, and now, the entire people that are able to solely live their diets without gluten.
It's been my impression that it's more people choosing this on their own than their physicians are telling them that they're gluten intolerant.
Mm-hmm.
And again, going back to the concept of gluten intolerance, being that you don't feel good when you eat the certain thing, but you're not damaging your intestine and affecting your vitamin levels and that sort of thing as you would be if you had celiac disease. The other important difference there is if you have gluten intolerance, you may be able to handle a little bit, but that's not true if you have celiac disease. You have to be a lot more strict if you have a celiac disease, and so it matters which one you have. To answer your question, I agree that it is sort of a trendy thing now, and our job many times is to try and sort out which of these different gluten problems it is, if any, and then most importantly, assuring that the child is on a balanced diet that's meeting their nutritional needs.
Now, I think the point we were trying to make is, Kaylee, I would agree with you. I suspect there may be a faster diagnosis, although the diagnosis leading to somebody like me sending somebody to Dr. Wilson is much easier than it used to be with these screening tests if they're done appropriately and interpreted appropriately. Then it becomes kind of easy. I can't do the biopsy, but I can get very, very suspicious that I'm truly living with one, and I don't find that many. So if everybody's got this all of a sudden, there is some over-interpretation and over-reliance on also our mental, our psychology makes us want to feel better with certain things. So there's a lot of reasons why this happens, including companies jumping on the bagwagon. They can make a little bit more money. And as I understand it, these products are often a little bit more expensive. Whether they're really that much more expensive to make, I'm not so sure. But
they definitely are more expensive. Most gluten-free options are at least a third more.
Right. If you've really got, what we're really saying here is if you've really got celiac disease, you really need to know that that is for sure what's going on for a number of reasons. And you can have wheat allergy, which is different. You can have gluten intolerance, which is not even allergy necessarily. So there are lots of ways foods can cause symptoms that are not necessarily celiac disease.
The other thing comes into this sometimes is when families sort of get on the bandwagon to eat healthier, a lot of other stuff's coming along with that too. They're not doing junk food anymore. They're taking the family out and exercising more. So for all different reasons, they feel more healthy and they have the benefit of that commitment to health.
And I've noticed that. That was one comment I was going to make is that these people are like, well, we must have celiac or some sort of intolerance because we feel better. And I'm like, well, you increased your vegetable intake by 3 times and you're eating healthier and being active. So of course you feel better.
Right.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Really,
I think you're thinking correctly out there, Kaylee. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Robin, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah. I have a son with type 1 diabetes. He has Hashimoto's. I myself have celiac disease and Hashimoto's. And so we had him tested for celiacs. We had that 4-part panel.
Right.
His AGA, IgG came out positive, but his IgA came out negative. The interpretation of the lab was results may support a diagnosis of celiac disease, but it's not specific. So I'm kind of wondering what to do with this guy. I mean, he's already got a couple autoimmune diseases.
Right.
I don't know if we needed to go and get a biopsy or just
take
him off gluten.
Yeah. Great question.
Did the panel that your child had include a tissue transglutaminase IgA or an endomysial IgA?
Yeah, it has the endomysial. It came out negative.
Negative on that.
And then the IgA came out negative. It said less than 1.2.
On the TTG, or was the they should do an IgA level just to make sure you're making some.
The TTG IgA came out negative.
Ah.
Okay.
IgA IgA came out negative.
So,
IgG that came out positive.
So I mentioned earlier that when we first started getting these blood tests, we biopsied people who turned out to be normal. Those are the people we were biopsying who turned out to be normal. The first tests that came along were the anti-gliadin antibodies, the IgG and the IgA. Mm-hmm. They are now the least accurate of the ones that we have available. And of the two, the IgG and the IgA for the gliadin, the least accurate of those is the IgG.
Mm-hmm.
So putting the whole panel results that you gave us together sounds to me, unless your child has already been taken off wheat, which will affect these results, but if your child's on a regular diet, it looks as though your child does not have have celiac disease and does not need a biopsy. But, you know, again, over the radio, we shouldn't be diagnosing people, yeah. So you should talk to your doctor.
What's your opinion about, I've read different places, people with thyroid disease actually do better on a gluten-free diet. It reduces the attack on the thyroid. Do you have any opinion about that?
Huh, that's an interesting question. Not being someone who takes care of thyroid disease, I can't really say.
Okay.
Let me ask a different question, Robin, that may come up, and I don't know the answer to this, so I'm answering this. So Robin's son now has a negative screening for celiac disease, yet he's got a couple of autoimmune problems. What's the risk that this will change over time and that celiac disease may later develop, yeah. even with negative testing?
Yeah. Yeah,
and then plus I have celiacs too.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. You know, I think it would be quite reasonable to relook at his serologies, meaning those blood tests that you did at some later date. And it's okay then to focus in on the ones that are more accurate mm-hmm. and just kind of monitor him. And you know, we treat patients, not lab results. So if your child comes in and he has signs that look like he may have malabsorption of his nutrients or could have celiac disease, isn't growing, has an exam that looks that way or is vitamin deficient, then we, you know, throw the tests out and do the biopsy and put our minds at ease on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Something to keep an eye on. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, great question, Robin. Good luck.
Thanks. Bye.
Let's take another caller. Shauna, you're on line one.
Hi.
Yeah, what can we do for you?
Hi. Hopefully a lot. I recently woke up one day and was incredibly 100% itchy all over my whole body, and it lasted like 3 days because I went on a fast. I just stopped eating everything. I went and had just a little blood comprehensive food panel done, and it came up with yeast, gluten, you know, all that good stuff, wheat. So I'm just wondering, like, is this a gluten allergy? Do I need to completely stay away from it? The itchiness never returned, but I did kind of start getting a little stomach issues. Just kind of wondering where to go with this.
I'm going to say a couple things and we'll see if Dr. Wilson wants to add anything. Generally just doing a bunch of blood tests without some historical information to correlate with it is you gotta be careful. And then second, there are a lot of providers, not all physicians, in fact, often not physicians, that are doing these blood tests that are positive for IgG antibody, like we just talked about, versus allergic antibody, which is usually IgE. And it is fairly well established. It's all over the internet if you want to look for it. If you've got IgG antibody, which most of these things I think you're talking about are, to foods, that's a normal response. Lots of people who have no symptoms have IgG to gluten and wheat and yeast and all that kind of stuff. So first off, you got to be very careful about the testing, and it takes a good history, physical, and correlating the two together. And another reason for that, even if you have really good allergy testing done by a board-certified allergist, a lot of positive tests still do not fit well with symptoms. So there are a lot of false positives, even on well done. So there's two issues there that make this mail order testing sometimes a little bit risky. Itching, I'm going to say, also is not something that makes me think about celiac or gluten intolerance off the top of my head. So
I also gained like 20 pounds in the last year out of nowhere. So that's
yeah. Celiac disease usually does the opposite to you, I think, is more likely. But let me ask Dr. Wilson to make some comments.
Yeah, I'd agree with that completely. Yeah. The allergy tests, even the more accepted ones, are not 100% accurate. So I would agree that you put those results together with what your own experience is with a given food. And it matters for you, but even to a greater extent, it matters to some of the children that we see who have been taken off, as the gastroenterologist that trained me used to say, they're just on half-strength water and a cracker. You know, they've taken them off everything else, and they come in growing poorly. And so we have to have some, have to think this through carefully before you eliminate, especially from a child's diet, a whole lot of different items, especially items that are in so many different things, such as wheat.
Okay. I'm just I don't know what to do now. I mean, they're telling me I've been off gluten-free for like two, or I've been gluten-free for 2 months now, and I'm not really having any more stomach issues. So, I mean, I guess that would be categorized more as an intolerance.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of right?
Yeah, and it may be, or it may be coincidental. Maybe just,
right,
and you got to look at the risk of what you're doing if you don't have any problems. I mean, I don't know. I don't know enough about what you did and the kind of test results you have. But I was extrapolating from a number of people who come to see me about these tests that are done, which really I think are not particularly valid tests. And so I'd encourage you. I'm hesitant today to try anything again. If you're doing well, you want to be careful out there. But I'm not sure we really know what's happening with you for sure.
Huh. Okay. So you don't think if I had some kind of gluten allergy that the itchiness would be? I mean, it went away.
Gluten allergy per se would be unusual to develop in your age group. Wheat allergy, which is a different allergy, but it's to a different protein than gluten. Protein in the food would be unusual to develop at your age. Certainly, you can have eczema and food allergies as well as gastrointestinal symptoms with wheat allergy. But I'm skeptical about it all being a true gluten allergy with you.
Okay. Now I have more questions. Okay. All
go,
right.
You can go to the websites on our our links on KSK. I'm trying to remember our website right now. I'm looking. Where is our website? AlaskaPublic.org. I'm sorry. And there are a couple of good links on there. And then the American Academy of Asthma and Allergy and Immunology put AAAI in, and you'll get to some good sites about allergy information.
Okay, thank you.
All right, good luck. all right, so we've talked a little bit about food allergy. There has been an increase, I think it's probably fair to say, in food allergies in the last 50 years or so. I think that's probably pretty well documented. And we're certainly seeing, as pediatricians, more gastrointestinal symptoms early in children. So perhaps we should just maybe mention food allergies as from a gastrointestinal standpoint briefly.
The symptoms of food allergy that we see in our practice are gastrointestinal. So there's a lot of people who have food allergies that may have eczema or asthma or something. We just don't see them. Probably the most common child that we see who has an allergy is the very young infant, 2 days to 2 months of age, who's having rectal bleeding from either a cow's milk or a soy protein formula. They've actually got an allergic colitis or inflammation of the colon due to allergy. And that's a condition that for the vast majority, the most part, is confined to that age group. It's really not something that we see in older children. And it's treated either by returning to breast milk, if that's an option, and sometimes with the mother removing those items from her own diet, or when it's not an option, placing the child on a formula where those proteins have been broken into little short chains of amino acids so they won't promote that allergic response.
So in those babies... may not be very colicky or fussy. They just get the blood in their stool, which is pretty obvious when this happens. And the good news is you remove the protein. And usually, by the way, allergy testing that's classic for allergies is not positive in those kids. So it's very important to be dealing with someone who understands that, because just removing the food is probably the best indication that you're doing the right thing, because symptoms go away very quickly, which is incidentally probably the best test for most allergies, is do things get better when you remove them? But anyway, and then they later don't have any problems.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, they
can go back to eating the milk or egg or soy.
Usually at a year of age, we transition them to regular milk without any difficulty. I should point out that there are other things that cause rectal bleeding in that age group that you want to look for. You know, they can get little anal fissures from the kind of explosive poops they have at that age, or they could have a bacterial infection. So it shouldn't always be assumed to be a milk protein allergy.
We have another caller, but before we go to that, I also would like to just talk briefly about lactose intolerance. This is another thing, different mechanism. Food goes into the gastrointestinal tract, you have symptoms, but it isn't all allergy. Lactose intolerance is what?
Well, milk is a complete food. It's got protein, it's got a carbohydrate, it's got a fat. The carbohydrate happens to be lactose. We have allergic reactions not to lactose, but to protein, which the milk protein, the soy protein in that milk product. So people who are lactose intolerant are not having an allergic reaction. They're simply not able to adequately absorb that lactose so that it reaches the colon unchanged, meaning undigested, where it's fermented by the normal colonic bacteria and you get gas, you get diarrhea, you just don't feel good. And you don't have symptoms like blood in your stool or vomiting. Those would be things that would make us think more about allergy. The other important thing about lactose intolerance that differentiates it from allergy is usually when you're allergic to something, you can't tolerate even a little bit. But people with lactose intolerance, it's a what we call a dose-related phenomenon. They can handle a certain amount, but if they exceed it, they've exceeded their gut's ability to digest that milk sugar, and that's when they start having the symptoms.
And they might also get better if they put something that digests the lactose in the milk, and then they can still drink the milk, showing it's not milk allergy. It's just you've digested that lactose.
Right.
So you can buy the product over the counter called Lactaid, and it really doesn't do anything except digest, lactose to galactose and glucose, which are easily absorbed across the bowel, don't need any more digestion.
And I think it's important to remember, too, that breast milk has lactose in it. So it's not like little babies have lactose intolerant. That wouldn't be very smart for us as trying to evolve human beings to have that happen. So adult onset lactose intolerance usually isn't going to be manifest prior to maybe at the earliest around age 4. In younger children, you can get it after maybe they've had a gastroenteritis, so they've sort of wiped out their gut lining temporarily, and they might have some symptoms for a little while, but then as soon as things get back to normal, they can handle their lactose again until they're a little older, and then they may follow the path of their parents and not be able to drink more than a cup or so at a time.
Allie, you're on line one.
Yeah, hi. I just had a few comments here, and coming from the experience of having celiac disease myself and it being in my family, and I know that it seems to be the trend or the hot topic these days, as everyone I know is a lot of friends that are finding out that they're celiacs, a lot of people have gluten intolerance, and I think I would just encourage people who are stressed out about it, not knowing what to do, to just go off of gluten. There's no harm in it. In fact, gluten itself is an inflammatory food. And I think the distinction to make with people is that the gluten we're eating today is not the same gluten our ancestors ate. It is a lot different. It's harder to digest. It's irritating to our gut, and considering we don't eat the best diets or as well as maybe we used to, it's harder for us to digest certain things. And so that's one point. I know someone said, well, if I'm feeling better, can I go back on gluten or not? Well, I mean, sure, you could try. You know, obviously I'm not talking from a doctor's perspective, but I have a lot of experience in herbal medicine and also just going through kind of my own experience of being diagnosed as a celiac, and I know that it can become, it's really challenging sometimes to figure that out because you can have one of 100 symptoms. And I just wanted to say quickly that I had all the itchiness and raised hives and skin irritation, and then it changed to significant joint pain. And those were all a result of the gluten I was eating. So, and that's pretty common, actually, of a lot of people that I know and experiences that they've been through. So, you know, it's it's actually not that hard to eat a gluten-free diet. It just requires shopping differently and knowing a few different things. So I think, you know, I would at least encourage anyone else who doesn't feel good, has digestive issues, you know, irritable bowel syndrome, skin stuff, headache, nausea. I mean, a lot of that stuff, you know, it's obviously more complicated than I'm talking about, but a lot of that can be relieved just by eliminating gluten. And I think the first step to that is actually knowing what gluten is and what it's in, because that can be really challenging.
Okay, thanks for your comments. All right, any comments?
Yes, I think the idea about putting yourself on a gluten-free diet, think about that with a child who hasn't been diagnosed yet with celiac disease. You don't really know whether they have it or not. It's a lifelong disease. And going on a gluten-free diet is going to make it much more difficult to diagnose that child. In fact, there's protocols for putting kids back on gluten so that you can make the diagnosis. So I would encourage anybody who has children and is thinking through this to see their doctor and not put their child on a diet before they really know what they're dealing with, because it can make it very hard to get to that answer later on.
We've only got about, you know, just a couple minutes, and it's not fair to ask this, but another disorder that's become a little bit more common, perhaps, certainly more in vogue, is inflammatory bowel disease, particularly one called Crohn's disease. And so this is another gastrointestinal disease that is not, is significant and is not necessarily related to gluten or wheat allergy. What are we talking about here?
Crohn's disease is one of the two inflammatory bowel diseases. The other one is ulcerative colitis. And these are conditions where there's chronic inflammation of the intestine. It comes about in a person that, again, has a genetic susceptibility. And it seems to be an inability of the gut to sort of what we call down-regulate inflammation, and an inability to sort of live in harmony with our gut bacteria. There's some very sophisticated mechanisms that allow us to tolerate the bacteria that live in our gut all the time and not make us sick. We all live with that every day. In people who have an abnormality of that balance, they can develop chronic inflammation, which leads to Crohn's disease, can cause poor growth, rectal bleeding, fever, abdominal pain, commonly in children, or ulcerative colitis, where the main symptom is bloody diarrhea. These are long-term conditions. They are not cured by a gluten-free diet. They're cured by very good medication. They're not cured. They're managed by very good medications.
Mm. And we're not sure why that disorder happens. There's something is turned on the inflammatory response, but there are easier to tell what hasn't. So we know for sure it's not wheat and it's not certain things, but we're still struggling with the main reason, and may genetics, again, may be a big part to play in this.
There may be a variety of environmental factors that come into play in the trigger of the disease in a person who with that genetic susceptibility.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dr. Wilson, it's been a real pleasure. This is a very confusing group of illnesses and problems for, I think, the public to hear about, and hopefully they've learned a little bit more about the complexities and the importance of getting a good diagnosis. I really appreciate you taking the time of being here. It's been wonderful.
Very happy to be here, Thad.
Dr. Claire Wilson is with the Providence Pediatric Gastrointestinal Clinic. If you put that in your browser, you'll find how to get to her. There's also some good websites on our website, line1 at alaskapublic.org. You can continue this conversation on our website at alaskapublic.org as well. And why don't you join us next Monday, January 23rd at 2 p.m. for the next edition of Line 1. Our topic will be pediatric pharmacology. We're going to be talking about what happens to those drugs once they enter our system, how are they developed, what kind of side effects might be expected, with some pediatric doctors of pharmacology from Providence Hospital, Ted Semper and Daniel Britt. So join us next Monday at 2 p.m. Pat Yack is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Specht is the web and audio engineer. Thanks for listening, especially to you who took the time to call.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.